What I want to do is share some of my own experience of the church in South Africa. In particular, to juxtapose or to set side by side a picture of Western Christianity duplicated in Africa versus African Christianity. My experience of the church in South Africa is that you can split it right down the middle into two radically different sides that, for the most part, want nothing to do with each other, or at least the one side wants nothing to do with the other side. On the one hand, you have what I call the historical churches in South Africa. On the other hand are the independent or spiritual. I'll use both names for them. We outsiders tend to call them independent churches because they are independent from us. They tend to call themselves spiritual churches, and I'll use both names for them. But this line separating the two cuts right down the middle of Christianity in South Africa. Now, you'll find this phenomenon of two styles of Christianity to be a prevalent one throughout the continent of Africa. But my experience was in South Africa, and that's what I want to speak about. Other countries, it can differ to a certain degree, so don't generalize completely for the whole continent. But in South Africa, you do find a split down the middle of Christianity, about half on either side, where there's literally virtually no traffic back and forth across this line, with only one exception that I'll refer to later. Christians on this side of the line want nothing to do with Christians over here. And Christians over here often have little to do with Christians over here. The independent church Christians often, not always, but often at least accept that these people are Christian. But I ought to be real honest with you and say that the people in these churches over here would not agree with me that these people are even Christian. They would claim that these independent church Christians have slid back into heathenism under the name of Christianity, but they're not really truly Christian. And some of the reasons for that we'll get into a little bit later. Let me also say, some of you are new to my teaching sessions here. I tend to get going real fast and pump out a lot of information as fast as I can, but I appreciate being interrupted once in a while. It gives me a chance to breathe and slows me down and reorients me toward your interests. So please know that you will be welcome if you have a question and you want to interrupt me with it. You'll probably have to almost think you're being rude to get my attention, but that'll be appreciated. As we go along, feel free at any point. We have a lot of time this morning, and we can do that. Historical churches. What do I mean by historical? Well, first of all, let's understand that the majority faith in South Africa is Christianity. Most of the people in South Africa are Christians. You find a certain Muslim community in South Africa, small, but there. You also find a small Hindu community because there are 750,000 Indian Asians living in South Africa, and they have brought with them their culture and their Hindu faith. And particularly in the Durban area of the country, you'll see a lot of Hindu temples. Those are both relatively small religious faiths in South Africa in terms of overall numbers of adherents. You find a larger number of people who practice traditional African religious beliefs. But most of the people in the country, something over 50%, would consider themselves Christians. Now, what do I mean by historical churches? I use the word historical, or historic churches, to refer to all those denominations operating in South Africa that have historical roots in Europe or the United States. So that would be virtually all the churches that we are familiar with, that we know. Roman Catholics, Anglicans, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Methodists, Congregationalists, Baptists, Apostolic Faith Mission, so forth and so on. All those denominations that start out in Europe or the United States and set out for Africa in an effort to duplicate themselves on African soil. And duplicate is really the key word here in terms of what happened. These are people who, the other day I mentioned German missionaries, German Lutheran missionaries, which is the tradition that I stand in. Their view was that before they could baptized, before they could train people in the faith, they first had to teach them the only language that God really understands, which is German. So they would the extent to which they were duplicating their faith was even to the point of duplicating the kind of language, the cultural language that they spoke. And this extended widely throughout mission practice. It still happens to a certain extent today, that we North American Christians believe we have the gospel. It's a gift from God which comes to us in a complete form. And therefore, the call of mission is a call to go out around the world and to give that gospel to people who don't know what we know. Full stop. And if you look at the historical churches in South Africa today, you can see where there has been a great deal of God's blessing as far as success in undertaking that task. You find among the churches in South Africa two kinds, among the historical churches, two kinds. One are English-speaking churches. The other are Afrikaans-speaking churches. And this is because the historical churches in South Africa, since they are a duplication of churches in European or North American society, it stands to reason that they would be led by whites. 20% of the population in South Africa is white. That's a pretty... That makes for a lot of whites, 4.5 million of them there, and there are plenty of whites to go around to fill most of the leadership positions. Now, these historical churches include a majority of black members, but most of the influence and leadership in those churches over the last 300 years has tended to be white.
How does that fit in with the apartheid policy? I don't you want to get into that here.
No, that's all right. What do you mean?
Well, I mean that you're going to have, I know that the whites are supposed to be in leadership to the blacks down there, but that you'd have the whites actually working in these black churches here. Is that consistent with the apartheid policy?
Yeah, it's kind of an exception to it. The apartheid policy would view it as the ideal that blacks should eventually be able to work in those black churches. And only at the denominational headquarters in Johannesburg would you have white leadership. But that's still a form of leadership. And most black congregations today in South Africa would be led by black ministers, but at a higher leadership level. Now, that was not originally the case. And it's always been understood that certain whites should sacrifice being able to live among their own people and engage in mission by going out and working among blacks. But even in the mission station where they live, they would live in a kind of white colony.
David, when you're saying whites, is this white male or is there white female leadership there?
Women's role in the churches in South Africa is even more backward than it is in this country at this point. For example, ordination of women is, maybe Larry has information on this as well, but my experience was that ordination of women is not even in the minds of most South African Christians at this point. Now, this would be true of the historical churches. Women play a very prominent leadership role in the independent churches, and we'll say more about that when we get there. But in the historical churches, the notion of male leadership is still pretty unassailed. So most of the members of these churches would be black, but most of the leadership would be white. For example, in the Anglican Church, most of the members are black. Most seminary students, consequently, are black. But most seminary professors are white. Well, that's starting to change now. It's probably half and half in the Anglican Church today as a result of changes in the last 10 years. On the level of bishops, it would still be the case that most Anglican bishops in South Africa would be white.
Do they have a separate hierarchy for the black and the white churches?
In some cases they do. It depends on the denomination. So here among the reason you have this split between English and Afrikaans is because since these churches are white-led, and South African white society is composed of two cultures that hate each other, English and Afrikaans, as the film demonstrates this afternoon, these are two white cultures that have no time for each other, they hate each other. And as a result, they don't mix in their political parties, they don't mix in their social circles. To a certain extent, they're even residentially segregated from each other. And certainly in their churches as well, they separate. Now, that means that over here on the Afrikaans churches, you have a white Afrikaans denomination. These are all Dutch Reformed churches. There's a white Dutch Reformed church, a colored Dutch Reformed church, a black Dutch Reformed church, and an Indian Dutch Reformed church, one for each of the racial groups. And the white Dutch Reformed church tends to pay most of the bills for all the other Dutch Reformed church. It also supplies a lot of ministers, white ministers, to those other churches. And in that way, it maintains control, even though these are supposed to be separate but equal denominations. In the English-speaking churches, more often than not, Lutheran, Catholic, Presbyterian, Methodist, more often than not, the denomination is multiracial. And it's just at the congregational level that you have racial segregation. For example, there are three Anglican congregations in the town of Craddock. One is white, one is colored, and one is black.
And if a black person wanted to go into the white congregation, they would be barred from that?
In some cases, it would be illegal for them. And in virtually every case, there'd be tremendous pressure against doing so, social pressure. Now, the exception is that in most major metropolitan areas, there is a downtown congregation, such as in Johannesburg. You have the cathedral right in the center of Johannesburg, which is not a residential area. And so members of the cathedral would come from various racial groups. So that most of Anglicans in most major cities have one multiracial congregation. But most of the congregations would at least have social pressure barring multiracial worship, if not formal legal prohibition.
Has there been any change in the last, say, 10 years or so in the mission perspective in Africa? I know the seminaries are starting to look critically at the way they view missions, and the training is starting to change, so there's less of that, exploring our culture. Has any of that gotten down to the level of working in Africa, though?
Yeah, I would say so. Certainly in terms of rhetoric, there is increasingly the rhetoric heard among these historical churches that as well as receiving funds from overseas, we have something to tell the people overseas. But what in fact has happened is that over the last century or so, we have duplicated our church to the point that my Anglican students, black Anglican students here in a seminary, would argue with me bitterly about whether or not it was right to be using drums in worship services. Yeah. Because they now have a lot of their religious identity caught up in the notion that the best way to be Christian is to do it exactly the way they do it in England. Mm-hmm. And Roman Catholics, since Vatican II, have been among the most progressive of all the historical churches in terms of beginning to indigenize worship through music and that sort of thing. But again, it tends to be foreign white missionaries who come down and now have to face the battle of convincing the local church, including black members, local African Christians, that this in fact is a good thing. And one of the reasons for that is because a lot of the Christians in these historical churches believe themselves to be vastly superior in their Christianity to the independent churches, and the independent churches, instead of representing Western Christianity duplicated in Africa, the independent or spiritual churches are authentic African Christianity. And as such, they have been using drums in their services for a long time. In fact, that's some of the reason why they broke off and formed their own churches, was so that they could have the drums. And a lot of the Africans who have stayed in these historical churches say, well, the reason our Christianity is better is that we're better than these people because they use drums, we don't. And so even if some foreigner comes from overseas now and starts telling them that drums might be all right, that threatens the whole rationale for why they think they're better than Christians over here. And that gets real dangerous. I mean, my students in the last resort of our argument would say, yeah, but if we bring drums into our service, well, everyone's going to think that we've taken this from the Zionists. Or the Zionists is another name for these spiritual churches. And God forbid that we should ever recognize that those people might have something worth teaching us, because then there would be a sudden flood of Christians rushing to join up those churches. Okay, let's move to the independent churches and talk a little bit about them. Well, one more point I want to say about the historical churches is that they train their leadership in virtually the same way we train leadership in the church here. because they represent a duplication of our style of Christianity. Likewise, they would duplicate the way they train a young man, there wouldn't be women in this case, for the ministry. And that is to have a heavy bias in favor of academic type training rather than practical type training. I mean, when a man or woman goes to seminary in this country, they spend at least probably 3 years doing academic book work and 1 year in a practical type training of an internship somewhere. And that reflects a certain bias which says the academic type training for the ministry is more important than the practical type training. Whereas in fact both we recognize as being necessary. And in the historical churches in South Africa, they duplicate this to the point where a young man training for the ministry would have much more heavily orientation toward academic type training than practical type training, which is a point that will become important later when we talk about the spiritual churches. Now, in order to really understand why the spiritual churches are independent from the historical churches, we ought to go back in history and look at some of the earliest examples of how Christians broke away from the historical churches and went off and formed their own independent denominations. Most of us, I'm assuming, are Lutheran. We don't want to be too self-critical here, so we won't look at any historical examples of Lutherans breaking away. We'll pick on Methodists. Any Methodists here? He's got a tough skin. I'm going to take one historical example from the Methodist Church, which is a true example, and which we could find similar examples for among virtually any historical denomination in South Africa. In about 1880, the Methodists in South Africa were organized in much the same way they are in this country, and that is in South Africa they're called circuits. And there is, within a circuit, maybe 50 different Methodist congregations, and in charge of the whole circuit is a supervisor. Well, in 1880, that supervisor was a British missionary who had been working in South Africa for his whole career as a missionary, and throughout his career it was his desire and effort to build up the black leadership of the church by finding certain black ministers, black men, whom he felt were called to the ministry, or who they felt were called to the ministry, and see that they got a good seminary training in South Africa. Once they had received their training, he ordained them. He very carefully supervised their leadership in a parish for a while. And a couple of the brightest black ministers he even sent to England to get further theological training. And all of this was with a view toward building up the black leadership of the Methodist Church within his circuit. Now, at some point, after a career of 30 years in the mission field, this British Methodist circuit supervisor died. And it was necessary upon his death for the Methodist Church to name a new supervisor of the circuit. And there were within that circuit at that time some highly qualified black ministers who had up to 20 years of experience as a minister in the church. At least one of them had even been sent to England to get further theological training, so he was well trained theologically, as well as having many, many years of experience as leadership of a congregation, a black congregation. But instead of naming that black man to be supervisor of the entire circuit, the Methodist Church sent out a 21-year-old graduate from a seminary in England. Fresh out of that seminary, he had no experience in a parish, no experience outside of his own culture, and he was named to be supervisor of the entire circuit. Because after all, if the effort is to duplicate European Christianity, who would stand a better chance of being able to do that than a European? Now, of course, it was inevitable in that kind of situation that a lot of decisions should be handed down by this 21-year-old supervisor, that the black ministers operating under this supervisor just found very difficult to deal with. Not only were they distasteful, but in some circumstances, the black ministers felt that the kind of leadership they were getting from the Methodist supervisor, in fact, inhibited the spread of the Christian faith. And so in 1884 in South Africa, a group of black Methodist ministers in this particular circuit broke off and formed their own denomination, because they said, to the extent that we remain within this historical denomination of the Methodist Church here, we will find ourselves getting leadership which actually inhibits our work as evangelists of the faith, and so we're better off without that denominational tie. And they broke away, formed their own Methodist Church, and for a long time it looked virtually like a duplicate of the old Methodist Church, except that there was black leadership now, and over time that black leadership evolved a denomination which in fact has a much different style of Christianity, as well as being led by different kinds of people. And that phenomenon of Africans breaking away and forming their own independent churches in South Africa is so prolific over the last century that it's estimated, and no one knows for sure, that there are something like 4,000 separate denominations of the African independent churches in South Africa alone today. Staggering figure. Although you ought not assume that all each of those denominations means everything that a denomination means to us. I mean, there are some of those 4,000, the largest, for example, which incorporates 250,000 members and is spread out in well-organized congregational units all over the country that have their annual synod or district convention or whatever you want to call it. There are some of these denominations that look like that, but more often a denomination would consist of fewer than as many people as we have gathered in this room right now, who meet in the home of a self-appointed minister on a Saturday night or a Sunday morning and call themselves the New Jerusalem Bible Church in Jesus Christ of South Africa. So what a denomination means incorporates tremendous variety here. And in most cases, it's a very small group of people which form what we would call one congregational unit.
How does that number compare with the numbers of historical churches?
Oh, I would guess there are a dozen major historical churches, maybe another 8 smaller ones. Now, some of these 4,000 are ever breaking away from the historical churches, but of course you also have, over the last century, the occurrence of schism among themselves, so that this does not represent 4,000 breaks away from the historical church. It represents some breaks in the initial instance away from the historical church, but later on it represents breaks from within the independent churches, or it may represent just the emergence of a new African church leader who doesn't break away from any church. One of my friends, Bishop Benet, told me the story of his church at one point, and he was not a Christian and received a vision one night, which he believes was a vision from God, calling him away from his immoral life of smoking tobacco and drinking. And the next morning he woke up and he went down the street where there was an independent church minister that he had heard about, and he told the man that of his vision, and the man said, well, you better join up, and he did. He joined up. Then a month or two later, he had to go back as a migrant laborer to Cape Town. While he was in Cape Town, he drifted in and out of several churches for a while, learning various church styles. Some of them were historic churches, others were independent churches. And as a member of an independent church, at one point he began holding prayer meetings in his home. And gradually, out of this circle of people that came to pray with him in his home, a new church was born, which wasn't necessarily a breakaway from any other church. It was just after he had experienced Christianity in the life of several different denominations over a period of about 5 years, he eventually felt called to form his own church. And what, in fact, some theorists suggest is happening in these independent churches is that since blacks are denied leadership roles virtually anywhere else in South African society, it's suggested that some of the reason for the wide proliferation of so many different churches is that this is the one place in South African life where a black man or a woman can assume a prominent leadership position. And so an individual who has natural leadership charisma will often work out that, I mean, will live out that those leadership gifts by forming a church. Now, I should qualify everything else that I say right now by admitting to you that after 2 years of working on both sides of this line and trying to get to know Christians on both sides of the line and having a particular interest in the spiritual churches, after 2 years of that experience, I feel like I've begun to have some idea of how much I don't know about the independent churches, which puts me in a pretty lousy position as far as teaching you about these spiritual churches. All I feel like I know is how much I don't know. But even that bit of knowledge puts me ahead of most of the people over here who are very sure they know that this is not Christian and that this is sliding back into heathenism. 99.9% of all the whites in these churches have never set foot in an independent church. They have heard the drumming from a distance. They have heard stories from their maids about what happens in those churches. But they have never had any direct experience of the churches, yet they are convinced, absolutely, that those are not Christian movements. And at least I have some sense that of what there is to explore there.
When I first look at that and think of 4,000 different types of churches, it's immediately it struck me as, gee, that's great. Because I think the way I view religion and theology, at best it can be a window to God and to the whole realm of what is the truth. I would guess in those churches you would find more of an individual experience in Christ, starting with just the message, and then people interpreting it and celebrating in their own way, and less emphasis on doctrine and the dogmatics of it. Is that
well? It would be fair to say I think that there is more of a focus on the message of God's Spirit and less a focus on the message of God's Word as contrasted with
the historical churches. The same? It seems like in our churches we have so much emphasis on believing this, this, and this, the dogmatics of it and the doctrine. And our main differences come in, we separate ourselves by what we do or don't believe.
Mm-hmm. Do
you find the same kind of competition over there, or is that pretty much...
Yeah, now I hear your question as far as competition. Yeah, there would be less competition among the independent churches than there is among the historical churches. Mm-hmm. And it would be common for an individual who belongs to an independent church to move among several different churches in the course of their lifetime. A key factor that we'll speak more about in a few minutes in terms of whether or not one joins an independent church is healing. Most of the people in independent churches have experienced healing of one sort or another. And that healing occurs at one point in their life in one church denomination. But 5 years later, they may have a healing crisis which is not resolved within the context of that particular denomination. And so they may float among several churches until they find a community where they are healed, and then they join. And that's there's no bitterness as far as their old congregation is concerned, that so-and-so has left us now, and that this is a scandal. As would be the case in our church or in our society, we tend to often belong to the same denomination that we're brought up in if we're Christians all of our lives. It's almost kind of an ethnicity sort of thing. I grew up in the Missouri Synod, and that's a highly ethnic organization, I think, in many ways. And certainly, well, you would have a certain amount of debate among independent church Christians about certain kinds of what we would call dogmatic assertions. Some theorists suggest that there are various strata of independent churches, that you have the Ethiopians at one end of the spectrum, the Apostolics in the middle, and the Zionists on the other end. And Ethiopians would be most similar of all three groups. They would most closely resemble the historical churches. Often the Ethiopians will dress in black instead of bright colors, whereas the Apostolics and the Zionists will dress much more colorfully in their worship. The Ethiopians sometimes distinguish themselves by saying, "We don't clap in our churches," because you don't clap in historical churches, whereas in the Apostolic or the Zionist churches, you know, with the chanting would come this kind of clapping. In some of the Ethiopian churches, you would find prayer books from the Methodists or the Lutherans, the Lutheran hymnal, being used as the order of service. Whereas in the apostolic or Zionist churches, it would not be the case. The Zionists would be the most radically different from our own churches, and would tend to have the least correlation.
Would the Ethiopians be related to the Coptic Christians?
Well, that's a good question. The best... certainly all of the independent churches, well, not all of them, some of the better educated people in the independent churches would point to the fact that the church in Africa is older than European missionaries, that as a result of the Coptic Christians or the biblical stories about the Ethiopian who was converted to Christianity. Philip, is it?
Yeah.
Was the origin of their churches. But I haven't seen any historical evidence for independent churches having existed in South Africa prior to about 100 or 150 years ago.
Do you know where the name comes from?
Ethiopia?
Yeah.
I'm sure that it is on the part of those Africans. These would represent the first churches. I mean, that Methodist example that I cited would be an example of an Ethiopian church. And I'm sure that those were well-educated black Methodist ministers who, from their own understanding of biblical scholarship and the history of Christianity, knew that the church in Africa could trace its roots to Ethiopia. And so they gave themselves the name of Ethiopian churches. There's a certain educational criteria here at work here. The more education you have as an African, the more likely you are to be a member of the historical churches. Or the same would be true that if you're a member of the independent churches, the better educated independent church Christians would be members here, and the further along the spectrum you go, the less formal academic Western education you would be inclined to have.
The Zionists would be, like we speak of Zionists, as far as a homeland in Israel or whatever.
I'm not sure why the name Zionist is used. Maybe it's Western scholars who have given them that. No, but Africans in the independent churches themselves, they refer to the Amazion, the Zionists. And I don't know why why the choice of that label.
There might be some kind of a. I'm just thinking of the kind of connection to some of the black churches in the U.S. They got the Methodists, black Methodists, you got the Amez ones, the American Methodist, African Methodist Episcopal Zion.
Mm-hmm. And, the AME would have a certain relationship over here, not so much here. Yeah.
With the increase of intellectual status, does there come sometimes a lessening of the trust in the healing mission or a certain suspect?
Yes and no. There would be healing. Healing would be taking place and would be important to the independent churches in any three of those categories, Ethiopian, Apostolic, or Zionist. But the techniques for healing would vary from one church to another. Whereas the Ethiopian church would not engage in hand clapping or dancing, ukujigaleza, to dance in circles, to run in circles until you get real dizzy, that kind of thing. Those techniques of ecstasy would be prominent in the Zionist church, would not exist to a large degree in the Ethiopian church. In the Apostolic church, they might clap, and then they would have secret services for the inner few, where they would dance in circles. On an average open Sunday morning, they wouldn't do this, but there would be times when the leader of the church would invite those people who are formed kind of the inner core, the good, faithful members, to attend a secret service where they might dance in circle. In the Zionist church, that would be an openly kind of thing. Now, those are various physical techniques of ecstasy that I believe are linked up with the approach taken to healing, with the experience of healing. In spite of all the variety present among the independent churches, in my experience that there's a you know, there's just so much there for us to study and to learn about that we don't know much at this point. I did feel that there were two themes that wherever I ventured among independent church Christians, I found two themes always to be strongly present. And I want to say a word about each of those. First is the theme of community. And secondly, healing. First of all, community, an independent church congregation, on the average, tends to be no larger than about 30 or 40 people. Because they find that this is as large of a group as you can have, and still everyone relates to each other in a real close-knit sense of community. In an independent church congregation, for example, it would be unthinkable that if there was a funeral taking place on the part of someone within the congregation or a relative of someone in the congregation, that the whole congregation, it would be unthinkable that the whole congregation would not be there present, that anyone would not from the congregation would not be present to be with their fellow member in this time of need. Now, if you belong to, as we do in this country sometimes, a congregation of 1,000 members, you just can't go to all the funerals. You take too much time out of your life. And you don't know all the people in your congregation. But in a spiritual church, they tend to have to be in small congregational units whereby they are able, each of them, to offer each other a tight-knit sense of community. And this, in fact, is what attracts many Africans into the Christian church, as well as the healing, is that a rural African who comes from a village in the rural area where there is a strong sense of community and where that person knows everyone else in the village and who comes into the city to look for work or for whatever reason and feels themselves now just totally without community, cut off from what was a world that they where they knew everyone and is dumped in the middle of Soweto now, often that will be the occasion by which an African will come to join a Christian congregation, because here they find a sense of community, which they feel lacking in their lives now, having moved from the rural area to the urban area. It's not the only way in which people join those churches, but it is one not uncommon way, according to... There is one study, for those of you who check out some of this in books, I know of one good academic study, a quantitative study by an anthropologist, a Christian anthropologist in South Africa called Martin West, entitled Bishops and Prophets in a South African City, which I think is available in paperback from an English publisher now. It was originally published in South Africa, and this is one of the conclusions that he reaches. If the congregation starts to grow and becomes 50 people in size, then it would be common that the leader of the congregation would, the bishop or whatever, would invite one of his assistant ministers who is already becoming a rather strong leader in his own right and maybe threatening the leadership of the bishop a little bit. He would invite that assistant to take some of the people from this congregation and form another congregational unit. And for a time at least, they would probably continue to remain within the same denomination. Although if this new minister felt that at some point he wanted to become the top dog, he may break off and form his own denomination. And this happens to a large degree. The most successful churches are the ones that grow the most, are the ones that also experience the most schism, because the leaders often of these churches, it is a certain financial enterprise for them. They receive a kind of offering or tribute from their members at various points during the year, and some leaders start to wonder, why should, if I'm running this congregation and I am the leader of this particular congregational unit, why every Easter or Christmas should we go here to the bishop's house and have my people all give him a lot of money, because we're not getting much in the way of help from him anyway. Why don't these people give me the money and I'll be their leader? That happens to a certain degree.
David, are most of the ministers then just part-time? They have some other full-time job?
Yeah, that's a good point. Most of the leaders of the independent churches are what we call the self-sustaining clergy. You know, they have their own independent means of financial support, and they do their Christian ministry as a kind of part-time activity. In their free time, they are ministers. Now, the exception would be someone who is both head of the church and also a healer. A lot of healing takes place in these churches. It is common that there would be two leaders within a congregation. The titular head of the congregation, the bishop, would be a male figure, and the prophetess would be a female healer. And that both kinds of leadership are necessary to keep the congregation together. A lot of people join the congregation because they're healed within that community, and there is an individual who coordinates the healing process, who has maybe certain healing gifts, which the bishop needs a good healer to have his congregation growing. But the healer, as a woman in a strongly sexist society, often finds it difficult to run the church herself, so she needs the male figure to draw people. Now, there are exceptions. I have a very close friend who I talked about the other day, a woman healer. On Saturday, we were talking about healing in some of the African churches. And she is an example of a woman who is both the titular head of the church and also its prime healer.
Do the independent churches maintain some allegiance toward the historical churches, knowing that it was from them that came not only the original seeds of their faith, but that life stream?
No, they don't. And they're totally independent. And often I've had some independent church people argue with me about whether or not I'm Christian because I wasn't baptized in the river. River baptism is an important condition for many of the people in those churches. And there are various ways by which they distinguish themselves. Now, I think that they tend not to be quite as chauvinistic about their type of Christianity as historical church Christians tend to be about ours. In other words, they tend to be a little bit more open to the fact that we might be Christians than we are to their Christianity. But I don't think, they have gotten nothing but flack from these churches, so there would be no reason for them to maintain a sense of respect that it is from these churches that we come. Now, maybe there would be more of that kind of thinking in the Ethiopian churches than there would be in the Zionist churches, because the style of worship would be more similar.
Are there main conflicts or differences between the two, theological or worship style? Or?
Yeah. Between independent and historical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Radical.
Yeah, which?
Differences. Although, of course, there would be also stylistic differences in worship ranging among the independent churches themselves. An Ethiopian church will look fairly similar in worship style to an historical church, whereas a typical Zionist service would take place in a round mud brick hut, maybe about this large in diameter, round mud brick hut with a cone-shaped thatched roof, dark, not much ventilation, any ventilation in some cases, and maybe 100 people a typical service would begin by the bishop saying to the children, okay, go start singing. And the children would go into the hut, which would have been cleared out, emptied, prepared for the service, and the children would just start the chanting. Let's, as a way of reminding ourselves that were these people here to introduce themselves to you this morning, they would certainly share with you a radically different sense of themselves than I ever can. I want to play some of the music from their churches, and I'm just going to turn it on in the background and talk over it for a while, as a way of keeping in the back of your mind the notion that if they were here, you would get a different picture of them than I will ever be able to give you.
Capture your imagination a little bit and plant some seeds of interest. But unless you follow up on those yourself and have your own direct experience, you will never know really what we're talking about.
Do they also have special clothes that are part of their worship?
Yeah, the uniform is an important thing. And in the case of the apostolics and the Zionists, it would be very colorful, and there would be a lot of symbolism on the robe. Well, there would be a lot of symbolism to the entire uniform, and it would be a highly treasured kind of thing. I have a videotape of independent churches where, and this is even true of historical churches, there are women's groups in the historical church that have their uniform. Now, they tend to be white and black, only, instead of red and green and yellow and all kinds of things as in the independent churches. But this black Methodist minister says on this videotape, the uniform, I've had members who have fallen away from the church, but who have come to me months or even a year later with their uniform saying, this thing hangs in my closet and it's haunting me. Because this is it's part of my Christian identity. And I've fallen away from the church, now I take this uniform away from me. Or the uniform hanging in the closet and bring the person back. But the uniform is very important. And within a given congregation, you can differentiate leadership levels by variations of the theme of the uniform. So that the bishop will have certain kinds of symbols on his uniform, that whereas the other people would just have plain garments, and he may have a half moon and a star and a cross on his. And his prophet may have something else. There's a lot of ranks of leadership within a given independent church congregation. And this now gets into the whole issue of how they do their leadership training. I talked about how in the historical churches, the model for leadership training is a duplicate of our own model, of heavy emphasis toward the academic study and less emphasis on practical type training. But in the independent churches, it's just reversed. The only seminaries that exist in South Africa are ones that have been built by Western churches for our affiliate denominations, with the result that independent church people often have little or no access to formal academic training if they want to take up theological ministry. In most cases, it has been the case that if a spiritual church, a minister wants to get theological training, and he or she comes over to one of the seminaries of the historical churches, they would be told, first you must become a true Christian. Then you can join, then you can come to our seminary. So first you must join our church, then you can have access to our theological training. Now, Lutherans have been among the first of the seminaries in South Africa to begin opening themselves up to taking some leaders from the independent churches. That's beginning to happen in the Lutheran and a couple of other seminaries in South Africa today. But it is still largely the case that an independent church leader has virtually no access to what we would consider academic theological training. And this is one of the reasons why historical church Christians would claim that independent church Christians are not Christian. Because they would say, their leaders don't have any education. How can they be Christian? Well, in fact, what they're saying there, they're reflecting a Western bias, that the only type of theological education available is an academic type. And that if you don't have academic training, you don't have any education. Whereas, in fact, an independent church minister could say the same thing of an historical church leader, who has had little or no practical type training, internship, for example. I mean, at the seminary that I worked in, there was virtually nothing happening in the way of our students getting exposure to the life of a parish and getting practice preaching, for example. They go through an academic course, they spend 1 year under as an intern, and then they're ordained. Well, they're ordained to a certain level even before their internship. Whereas in the independent church, once you join, after you've been a member for a while and you've learned the rubric of the liturgy, maybe you would be invited to take on the post of doorkeeper. Now, to be a doorkeeper, you let people in and out. People don't all come at once. They come throughout the service. And if you're going to let people in and out during the service, you have to understand the liturgy to know at what points can people come in and at what points must the door be kept closed because you're engaged in prayer, for example. And people don't come in and out during the prayer. So that's a stage of leadership where you by trial and error, learn about the service, and then you might graduate from that level to becoming a regular preacher or a healer, or there's various levels of leadership, all the way up to receiving a kind of ordination and then eventually becoming a bishop.
Would there be anything like an oral tradition within these independent churches, in which they would attempt to have something in common to transmit now to, or isn't there enough historical perspective?
Well, it's a good question. To what extent is the oral tradition, which is a traditional aspect of African culture, In what way does it make itself felt in the practice of these people's Christianity? I mean, when I think of the oral tradition, what I think of are stories of history being transmitted down from one generation to another. Now, I suppose there would be a certain, there would be a sense of, within a given independent church denomination, there would be stories about how this, about the history of this denomination. If they were founded by a now dead leader, I'm sure there would be a lot of stories about that leader. And for the most part, none of this would be written down. It would all be orally transmitted. But there is also a focus, a literate focus now, because of Scripture. Scripture plays an important role in the life of all these churches. I think that's a fair generalization to make. And the leader of the denomination may not necessarily know how to read the Bible, but he or she will try and make sure that there is someone in his congregation or her congregation who can read the Bible. And Scripture plays a prominent role in the middle, so that it's not all the world.
What about the sacraments?
There would be a certain attention given to the sacraments. The sacrament of baptism would be probably the most important sacrament for them. As I said, it's river baptism, and if a person comes from an historical church and joins an independent church, they may be invited to engage in the rite of baptism again. Or even transferring from one independent church to another independent church. In some cases, you might be invited to be rebaptized, although in many cases, the rite of baptism would be accepted across lines. This would vary a lot. But baptism is certainly a key sacrament around which a whole theology is developed about your life as a new person now. I participated in, I think, one of the most meaningful baptism rituals that I've ever participated in. It took place in a very remote area where we had been worshiping. We started at 10 o'clock at night. We went until about 5 in the morning when the bishop started falling asleep during one of my sermons. And then he decided it was time to close things. But during the course of the night, about halfway through the night, two young women were brought forward and sat in the middle of the room, and they began to be instructed by all of the sermons in baptism and what does it mean to be baptized. Now, this would not have been the first time that these women heard it. It was the first time that such instruction was directed at them. But every time a baptism took place in this church, the focus for the whole service would be on baptism. And what I started talking about the service before, and how you go through preaching and prayer and chanting and all this. You would also have many people would preach in the course of a given service, which is partly where the practical type of leadership training comes from. So the bishop would preach first, and he or she would set the text on which future preachers would address themselves. But successive sermons would always add to what the bishop had said. And which doesn't mean that it's a theological free-for-all, because at the end of all these different sermons, and maybe in the course of a night, virtually everyone present would have the opportunity to speak, at least for a couple of minutes. At the end of that, the bishop would stand up and would lift up the preaching of certain people whom he felt had accurately interpreted the Word of God. Other people who maybe he felt had raised theologically dubious points, he might correct. And that's not a source of embarrassment as it would be in our culture. It's in African culture to be corrected in a public group kind of thing like that. That's perfectly natural. There's no embarrassment that goes along with that. So that the sermons in the middle of this all-night service were increasingly addressing themselves to the young girls. And we took a break for about an hour or two before dawn, and then someone came and woke me up and said, okay, it's time to go to the river. And we were halfway up the side of the mountain, about 3 or 4 miles away from the river. And it was still dark. We started marching with the drums, and the people in their long white robes by moonlight. We made our way through the village down to the river, and just about the time the sun was coming up, at sunrise, we were at the river. And we gathered in the circle and danced around these two young girls who were in the middle of the circle, and the bishop was starting out to really shout at them because there was a crescendo to the music, all the drums beating and the people dancing and singing, and the bishop was talking to the young girls and praying for them. And special blessing was said for them, and then they were taken into the river and baptized. And then afterwards, there was some more prayer, and then in a real spirit of fellowship, we then marched back up to the church. And that was a very meaningful baptism in that river at sunrise after an all-night service.
What about communion?
Communion is present in many of the independent churches. I would hesitate to say that all of them practice communion, but as a wild guess, you know, I told you, I don't know. All I know is how much I don't know. But as a wild guess, I guess that maybe half of them have some celebration of Holy Communion. Frequently at night, and well, there would be a whole range of the way in which communion took place, and would in some cases involve would integrate animal sacrifice into the ritual of Holy Communion, so that there would be actual a feasting of more than just a symbolic piece of bread and a sip of wine. There would actually be the slaughter of an animal, which would involve real blood there, not necessarily that you would drink, but there would be real blood in the ritual, and then a feasting. The animal that was slaughtered would be cooked, and would be more of a genuine, you know, what we would think of as a real meal, as opposed to a symbolic meal.
Do you find much of an incidence of crackery or occultism within they can happen in any kind of church, but it seems to me to happen more often here in this country anyway, in some of the less formal churches. Do you find it much in South Africa?
Well, the word I might want to use is charlatanism.
Okay, fine.
There are leaders,
it's inevitable sometimes,
who, frankly, give me the impression that they're in it for the money. Now, I have seen situations where I question the integrity of the leader, but still have very high regard for the integrity of the member of that church. So I wouldn't want to call into question the entire church, because I might question the motivation of a particular leader involved. And frequently, this may be on the part of the son of a founder of a church, who you know, might be a drunkard and just collects the money and really isn't into theology at all. But the people, out of respect for the family of the original founder of the church, have made, upon the death of that founder, his son to be the new leader, and this can lead to a lot of problems. But I wouldn't want to call into question then the integrity of the member. I found that to be very high in all the cases as well. Helen?
Yeah. I would think you'd see more of that in the historical church because of the formalization or whatever you want to call it, because it's profitable and it's more success is more connected with being an English Christian.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I should never have answered your question the way I did, without also adding that I've seen plenty of historical church ministers whose motivation I would question. It wouldn't necessarily be a purely monetary motivation, but in the historical churches, if you become an historical church minister, you are at the elite of your society. In a rural African culture, to a degree that we as Americans can't even begin to relate to, the minister is a highly regarded community leader. And in some cases, it's just, among my students, there are many whom I question with, what was the nature of their call? And in some cases, I really felt strongly that it was just an elitist kind of thing. They had tried one field, and they really weren't satisfied that they were looked up to the degree that they thought they should be. And so then they went into this field.
Is it possible to say whether there is a common religious illusion in the chanting and the sermons and the other aspects of church life? What I'm thinking about is that it runs all the way through Black American Christianity, that you have the picture of a better future, and it comes out in the midst of presence. So suffering, and it comes out in spirituals, and it comes out in preaching of hope, and it comes out in the use of the same biblical passages again and again, the Exodus experience as well. Mm-hmm. Do you know if there's a kind of common religious vision that is a rather continuous strain?
There must be, but I would hesitate to say for sure or to point to what it might be until I became really fluent in Xhosa, and I'm not at this point. I mean, I can communicate, but I'm not fluent. And I think one would need to live among a variety of these churches for a real significant period of time and to speak the language fluently before you could begin to pick out some of these motifs, the theological motifs that would be mm-hmm. common. But I'm sure that there must be.
Mm-hmm. You said you would address how the religious services in the lower churches related to the charismatic.
Yeah, I want to do that after I talk about healing. Maybe one more question, and then I want to talk about healing for a little while.
I had thought that Larry's question was going to be mine, and mine's a little more specific. As this chanting was going on here, is there movement in the service, as there is in art, from one spiritual concept, shall we say, to another,
yeah.
Or is it all spontaneous and just all mixed up?
No, it is much more spontaneous than in our churches, but there is a pattern in a given church. In a Zionist church, it might, you would know that at some point you're going to do the dancing, you're going to run in circles, and this is part of your worship style. And then after that, at the end of almost any independent church, there will be a period where the leaders of the congregation stand in the front, and the people come one by one during one great final chant, where everyone's really at the top of their voices, and hands are laid on the head of each individual in this kind of blessing. That's a very common practice in the independent churches, and that. You would know that in the apostolic churches, early in the service, you might say the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed, or something like that.
Is this chanting, does it have some message in it? Like was there a confessional part for are they confessing their sins at some point when they're using these ancient forms?
No, the words of the chant are not important.
No, I think
that. They are important. One says, we praise you, one says, let's go to Jerusalem. But basically the words are not so important, and they can be used at any point in the service. And the chanting is always the most spontaneous part. How long it goes, when it happens, that sort of thing is very spontaneous. But you would know in coming to a church that you were familiar to, that if you walked in and people were saying the Apostles' Creed, that you're fairly early in the service. If you walked in and the blessing, the laying on of hands was taking place, that would symbolize late in the service. If you walked in the middle of a chant, you would have no idea at what point in the service you were at.
Okay.
I think something, just like to add as far as the chanting, I think our Western culture, we tend to see music as kind of limited. We have to have the words, and it has to make sense, and it has to go on. In a lot of other cultures, music is expressing so much more. Very emotional, heart and soul into it, and it's saying things that are beyond words, so it's not at all meaningless, but the emphasis isn't on the words anymore, mm-hmm. but the music itself is really saying something significant to people
yeah.
who understand that kind of communication.
Yeah, I want to address that and healing and several other things that we'll do, so I think I'll ask you to hold off on the questions for a little while, because I got some more of my presentation. The best is yet to come here.
Yeah.
Give me a chance to finish that. I want to talk about healing, because this is the source for a lot of feeling in the historical churches, that the independent churches have slid back into heathenism. So before I can describe healing in African spiritual churches, I need to back up and talk about what does healing look like in traditional African society. And then you'll be able to better understand what happens in an independent church service. In traditional African society, if you get sick, you would go and consult the Ekpecha. Some missionaries might call him or her a witch doctor. I think that term leads to more misunderstanding among Americans than it does understanding, so I prefer to use the name that they use for themselves. As traditional healers, they call themselves Ikweka in Xhosa society. Now, Ikweka, you would come into my hut if you were sick with your whole family, because health is always viewed as a problem of the entire family. And the symptoms illustrated in a child may in fact be due to problems experienced on the part of the parent. So you would come with your family into my hut, and before you started telling me why you had come, I would throw the bones, and in reading the bones, I would say, you've come because so-and-so in your family is having a sunstroke. Now, if I'm accurate in my diagnosis, then you know you're working with the right healer. If I tell you you have a stomachache and you got a headache, maybe you would take your business elsewhere. But more often than not, the healer would be accurate. Now, don't ask me to explain how this happened. I don't know. I can't explain it, but it happened. In traditional African society and in these independent churches, there is a process of diagnosis which we have no equivalent for in the West and which we cannot explain. And having told you what symptoms brought you, then I would go into why you were experiencing these symptoms. You know, in African culture, traditionally, people are here, the ancestors are here, and God is up here. And you have certain obligations as people to, in the form of certain sacrifices, etc., that you make to keep your ancestors satisfied with your life. And the ancestors, in turn, if they're satisfied, will use their good graces to mediate with God on your behalf, to protect you from the evil spirits, or to invoke God's grace. Now, maybe Eisen Clerkel would tell you that the reason you're experiencing this problem today is because after the birth of your last son, you neglected to slaughter a sheep, as is prescribed in traditional African religious belief. And so the ancestors, having been denied this thank offering, are a little angry now. And they, therefore, have withdrawn they are no longer mediating with God on your behalf, and so these problems have beset you. But now, having angered the ancestors, it's not going to be so easy as it would have been if you, in your own home, had slaughtered a sheep. So now you're going to have to bring a goat, which is higher than a sheep, to my place, because I know I know how to communicate with the ancestors and God better than the average member of the community, as the healer, as the priest. And so you bring a goat to my place next week, and we will slaughter in the prescribed ritual fashion, and in this manner we'll hope to put you back in God's good graces. Traditional African healing approach. Okay. Now, in the independent churches, I have a friend, this woman I told you about, who's a healer, who has said to me that on her own, she can do no healing. She says, God works through me to grant special blessings to me, to answer the faith of Christians that come to me in need of healing. But without that faith on the part of my patient, that Christian faith on the part of my patient, and without God's special blessing at any given point, I can do nothing. Yet, over the course of 20 years of her ministry, there has been a coincidence of these factors, and she is well known around the country as a healer. Now, she's told me that, we talked about some of the healing, the techniques of her healing on Saturday, so I don't want to go into that again right now. But she's told me that in certain extreme cases, she will prescribe the ritual slaughter of a goat. Now, right away, Christians in historical churches see this going on, and they see these people have slid back into heathenism. Here they're practicing animal sacrifice, without taking a second look and finding out that, in fact, she conducts that animal sacrifice with a profound difference from the way the Afrika would do it. For example, she says, I will collect the blood of the animal. Now, in traditional African ritual animal sacrifice, the blood of the animal plays a very key role. And you never let even a drop of the blood fall to the ground without having to start all over again. Because the blood is very special to the ancestors, and you've got to pay particular attention to it. Any self-respecting Afrika would be horrified if you let even a drop of the blood fall to the ground. Now, my friend says that she'll collect the blood of the animal, and at some point she'll bury the whole amount in the ground. Dramatic act of sacrilege. I mean, she is attacking the traditional African culture at this point, not affirming it. But, of course, a white outsider would have a very difficult time understanding that. And as she buries the blood in the ground, she says to her patient, look, you and I are Christians. And as Christians, we have already been saved by Christ, blood, which paid the price for our sin, and so we have no need for this part of our traditional African ritual. And now that, to me, is an example of taking a traditional custom, cultural custom, and altering it in such a way as to communicate the essential nature of the Christian message. And frankly, I have no problems with that. I think that we've begun to learn from our study of anthropology and psychology that you never cut people off from their traditions. All you ever do is evolve cultural traditions in such a way as to communicate new meaning. And that's exactly, I think, what she has done. Although, of course, to an outsider, or to traditional missionaries, it looks as though she is, under the guise of Christianity, continuing to practice the old custom. The interesting thing is that I mentioned earlier, there's only one example of traffic back and forth across this line. And for the most part, these two groups of Christians have nothing to do with each other. And the only example where there is contact is on the part of black Christians in historical churches who, when they get sick and are in need of healing, at night they sneak over here. They don't admit it, because it's a great disgrace to, as an educated Christian among the historical churches, to be found with the independent church. But it happens a lot. I saw it. I mean, when I was staying in this woman's place, one day she dragged the old man and said, "See, here, this is what I'm talking about. This man is a Methodist preacher. And on Sunday morning, he stands up in his congregation and he preaches against me. But tonight he's sick. And he's come for healing." As one way of moving toward a closure on the presentation, and we can carry on discussion till lunch, but I want to share one more thing with you which illustrates some of why I went and got involved with them and some of the basic lessons that I think we can learn from this. Now, whenever I showed up in an independent church service, there was a great deal of shock, to put it mildly, because their only experience of a white or even a black from the historical churches who comes over would be to try and convince those people that they should join true Christianity. And yet, because I was white in a society which adhered to white supremacy, there was a certain degree of politeness extended to me, and so it was common if I walked into the service that the leader of the congregation, the bishop, would very quickly after I joined their service for the first time, would call a halt to the chanting, would acknowledge my presence, and then turn it over to me for a word. And I had a standard way of introducing myself at that point, which I want to share with you. But before we do that, why don't we pause with the rest of the village for a straight African style. If I was speaking to them, I had a standard kind of line that I would give in this situation, and I want to share that with you. I said, "When God called me to be a minister to my people, I followed the custom in my country, and I went to the university to study. But I went with a very clear sense that not all was well within my church. In fact, as I looked around at my church, I felt we were faced with some very great problems, because most of my young friends had fallen away from any kind of active participation in the church, and I considered that a sign of ill health on the part of my church, that we were no longer attracting young people to Christian worship, at least not in the same kind of numbers. And I felt that part of my call as a minister was to try and understand this problem and to address myself to it, that the church would remain strong through the continuing participation of young people. And in the course of my studies, I learned that there are two parts to God's message. That there is the message of the Word, and there is the message of the Spirit. Now, what I did not share with them, but I will share with you since you're a better educated audience, is that I think there's a certain scientific basis for this kind of theology. Psychologists today are beginning to tell us that there are two spheres of our brain, and that one half of your brain is where a logical, mathematical, rational, reason-type mental life is centered, and that in the other half of your brain, that's where aesthetic, musical, artistic, the non-rational type mental life is centered. And they're even saying that it appears certain cultures have a tendency to develop one half of the brain more than the other half of the brain. That at this point in human evolution, tend to emphasize one side of the brain over against the other. Well, if that's true, there's no question which side of the brain Western culture emphasizes. It's that rational side. And as I looked at my church, believing that there were these two sides to the message of God's word, I felt that maybe we had been more richly blessed in our understanding of the message of God's word than we had been in an understanding of the message of God's spirit. For example, our ministers were highly trained in an academic sense, and our people knew a lot about doctrine and reason and these sorts of things. And our whole culture had developed a scientific method which could create massive, beautiful structures in which to worship. My young friends, who are no longer participating in the worship life of a congregation, have a rational basis for what they believe. But what they lack is any kind of spiritual attraction to participating in the worship life of a congregation. So I felt that maybe my church back home had been more richly blessed in its understanding of the message of God's word than we had been in an understanding of the message of God's spirit. And I went back to my studies, to my training, to see if I couldn't learn more about the message of God's spirit as a way of equipping myself and to minister in a more holistic fashion to my church. And I learned in the course of my studies that there was a church in Africa which was richly blessed in its understanding of the message of God's Spirit. Independent Church Christians will worship all night long, three or four nights a week, and then come together for a five-hour service on Sunday, instead of having difficulty, as these churches do, in drawing half of their membership for 1 hour on Sunday morning, a condition familiar to ourselves. I felt that maybe I learned that they were more richly blessed in an understanding of the message of God's Spirit than they were in an understanding of the message of God's Word. And so I prayed that God would give me some opportunity to go to Africa and to live among these people, that I might better learn about the message of God's Spirit in such a way as to equip myself to go back to my people and to minister to this problem that my church was having. And as you see me standing in front of you today, you know that prayer has been answered. Well, now when I introduced myself to an independent church congregation that way, one thing was immediately very clear. I had not come to duplicate my style of Christianity among men. And the ironical thing is that in almost every situation that I thus introduced myself, someone would stand up as soon as I had finished and say, well, we see that you have not come to convert us to your church. But we also know that you have an understanding of the word which our ministers have not had, because we haven't had the opportunity to study the Bible. So we want to know, will you set up some Bible lectures for us? The very opportunity that is consistently being undertaken, I mean, it's consistently being sought for by church Christians over here who try and get at these people to give them the word, that very opportunity was made available to me because I had come not to give them the word, but very clearly stating that I recognized I had a problem which I thought they could minister to. And that is more than the contemporary rhetoric of saying, we need to be learning from these people. It's different to say, I have a problem, to critique ourselves to the point of recognizing that we have a weakness, and to believe that another culture may be able to answer that weakness, than it is simply to say, well, we will go out and we'll try and learn from these people as we give them the work. Those are two different things. And I think as I look at the history of Christian mission in South Africa or in any other part of the world, that we have been much better at sharing our strength with other Christians, other peoples of the world, than we have been at seeing what they have to offer up. Because if we look at the church in South Africa today, one half of it is a duplicate of ourselves. The other half is a creative renewal of Christianity within an entirely different cultural context. And if we had started off this hour by my asking you, what kinds of mission projects do you think we can engage in vis-a-vis the church in Africa, 100% of your suggestions would have been aimed right here. Those Christians that have the most to teach us in Africa are the same ones that we are most out of touch with. And I spend an hour and a half trying to develop that point today. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to make the same point political. that the people in Africa who have the most to offer us politically, our nation, are the same people that Americans are most out of touch with and indeed estranged from. Because our own Western culture believes that we got it, and the call of mission is to give it to others.